Moore was not the only one to visit. Liana returned to him from the grave, a dark, flickering plasma who smiled down on his frozen features and shook her head and whispered, "You poor man, so lost, so arrogant," before the sun called her back home. Chinedu Mofegbu stood for hours at his side and spoke with fingers and eyes and sounds that stuttered from the back of his throat, and somehow Brooks understood him at last. Not the ululating cipher, not the intelligent hive cancer, but a kind old man whose fondest childhood memory was the family of raccoons he had surreptitiously befriended with a few handfuls of kibble and subtle sabotage inflicted on the latch of the household organics bin.
"Wait, you had a childhood?" Brooks tried to ask.
But Ofegbu's face and hands had disappeared under eruptions of buboes and great ropey tumors, and he could no longer get out the words. Rona even came back from heaven, though she'd sworn she never would. She stood with her back to him and fumed. He tried to turn her around and make her smile, but when she did, the expression was bitter and furious, and her eyes were full of sparks.
"Oh, do you miss her?" she raged. "You miss your mindless puppet, your sweet, adoring ego-slave? Or is it just the fact that you've lost the one small fake part of your whole small fake life where you had some kind of control? Well, the chains are off, Dan. They're off for good. You can rot out here for all I care." "But that's not what I meant," he tried. And, "I never thought of you that way."
And, when he finally ran out of denials and had nothing else to say,
"Please, I need you. I can't do it on my own." "Of course you can't," she sneered. "You can't do anything on your own, can you? I'll give you that much. You've actually turned incompetence into a survival strategy. Whatever would you do if you actually lost your excuses, if you ogged up like everyone else? How would you ever survive without your disability to invoke when you can't keep up?"
He wondered what heaven could possibly be like to make her so vindictive. He would have asked, but Rona had turned into Rakshisa and Gupta right in front of his fossilized eyes, and her train of thought seemed to have jumped to a whole different track.
"You gotta stay away from the bow,"
she whispered urgently, glancing nervously over her shoulder.
"You gotta stay out of the attic. He's in there now, and maybe something else. I wish you'd come back. This could be bad, and I'm only good with numbers, you know. I'm not so hot in meat space."
"You're doing fine," Brooks tried to say. "You're even starting to talk like one of us roaches." But all he could manage was a croak and a cough, and whatever Rakshi heard seemed to scare her more than his silence had. Sometimes he opened his eyes to see Moore looming over him, moving shiny, blinking chopsticks in front of his face. Once or twice, an invisible, roaring giant stood on his chest, pressing him deep into the soft earth at his back. The sparse bands of new-grown grass in the bulkhead bowed low against the wall, every blade in uniform alignment. Other times, he was as weightless as a dandelion seed. Sometimes he could almost move, and the creatures gathered at his side would startle and pull back. Other times he could barely roll his eyes in their sockets. Sometimes he woke up. Something sat at his side, a vaguely humanoid blur at the edge of eyesight. Brooks tried to turn his head, unfix his gaze from the ceiling. All he could see was pipes and paint.
"It's only me,"
Moore's voice. "Is it? Is it really?"
"I guess you weren't expecting it," said the blur. "I'm actually surprised that Sengupta didn't tell you. It's the kind of thing she'd enjoy spreading around."
He tried again. Failed again. His cervical vertebrae seemed fused somehow, corroded together.
"Maybe she doesn't know."
Brooks swallowed. That much he could do, although his throat remained dry. The blur shifted and rustled.
"It's a mandatory procedure where I come from. Too many scenarios when conscious involvement compromises performance. Whatever the military is these days, you don't get into it unless you..."
A cough. a reset.
The truth is, I volunteered. Back when everything was still in beta, before it was policy.
Do you get to decide, Brooks wondered, when it comes and goes? Is it a choice, or is it a reflex?
You may have heard we just go to sleep, lose all awareness, let the body run on autopilot, so we won't feel badly about pulling the trigger afterward.
Brooks heard a note of bitterness in the old man's voice.
It's true enough, these days. But we first-gen types, we stayed awake. They said it was the best they could do at the time. They could cut us out of the motor loop, but they couldn't shut down the hypothalamic circuitry without compromising autonomic performance. There were rumors floating around that they could do that just fine, that they wanted us awake, for debriefing afterward, experienced observer in the field and all. But we were such hot shit, we didn't really care. The sexy bleeding edge, you know? First explorers on the post-human frontier.
Moore snorted softly.
Anyway, after a few missions that didn't quite go according to plan, they rolled out the Nirvana iteration. Even offered me an upgrade, but it... I don't know. Somehow it just seemed important to keep the lights on.
Why are you telling me this? What does it matter now that you've thrown the world's lifeline into the sun?
What I'm saying is, I was there, the whole time. Only as a passenger, I wasn't running anything. But I didn't go away. I'm not like Valerie's mercenaries. I was watching, at least. If that makes you feel any better. Just wanted you to know that.
It wasn't you. That's what you're saying. It's not your fault.
Get some rest.
The blur stretched at his side. The colonel's face resolved briefly in Brooks's field of focus, faded again to the sound of receding footsteps, which paused.
Don't worry,
Moore said.
You won't be seeing it again.
The next time he woke up, Sengupta was leaning over him.
How long?
Brooks tried, and was relieved to hear the words come out. She said, Can you move yet? Try to move. He sent commands down his legs, felt his toes respond, tried wiggling his fingers, his knuckles were rusted solid.
Not easily, he said.
It'll come back, it's just temporary.
What she do to me?
I'm working on that, listen.
It's like some kind of ass-faced, ass-backwards crucifix glitch.
His tongue fought its way around the words.
How the hell did she... Baselines don't glitch. We don't have the shirkets.
I said I'm working on it. Look, we got other things to worry about right now.
You've got other things, maybe. Where's Jim?
That's what I'm trying to tell you. He's up there in the attic. He's up there with Portia, I think.
What?
Well, how do we know how far that shit spread, huh? It could have coated the whole inside of the array and we never would have known. Could have grown all the way up to our front door and got inside.
His sympathetic motor nerves were still working, at least. Brooks could feel the hairs rising along his forearms.
Anybody take samples?
That's not what I do. I'm a math maid, not a bucket boy. I don't even know the protocols.
You couldn't look them up?
It's not what I do.
Brooks sighed.
What about Jim?
Sengupta stared past him. No help. He just keeps reading those letters from home over and over. I told him, but I don't think he even cares.
She shook her head. She did it so effortlessly. Added,
He comes down here sometimes, checks up on you. He's been shooting you up with all sorts of GABA and spasmolytics. He says you should be good to go by now.
He flexed his fingers. Not too bad, this time.
It's coming back, I guess. Body's just out of practice.
Yeah, it's been a while. Anyway, I gotta get back.
She stepped across the hab, turned back at the base of the ladder.
You gotta get back in the game, Dan. Things are getting weird.
They were, too. She'd never called him by name before.
He'd stopped slurring his words by the time Sengupta had departed. 5 minutes later, he could roll from side to side without too much discomfort. He bent knees and arms in small, hard-won increments, ratcheting each joint against the brittle resistance of his own flesh. At some critical angle, his right elbow cracked, and pain splintered down his arm like an electrical shock. But the limb worked afterward, bent and straightened at his command with nothing but a dull, arthritic aching in the joint. Encouraged, he forced his other limbs past their breaking points and reclaimed them for his own. Reclaimed from what, he wondered. The medical archives reenacted the corruption of his flesh in fast forward. A body flooded with acetylcholine. Renshaw cells compromised. ATP drawn down to the fumes by fibrils that just wouldn't stop clenching. No ATP to cut in and ask myosin for this dance. Nothing to break the actin-myosin bond. Gridlock. Tetany. A charley horse that froze the whole damn body. The mechanism was simple enough. Once the action potentials started hammering that fast, it could only end one way. But this didn't seem to be drug-induced. Valerie hadn't spiked his coffee or slipped anything into his food. His medical telemetry hadn't picked up the trail until long minutes after Brooks had been hit. But as far as he could tell, those signals had come from his own brain. CNS to alpha motor to synaptic cleft. Boom, boom, boom. Whatever this was, he'd inflicted it on himself. He took his time in checking out. Time to extract the catheters and stretch his limbs. Time to boot his defossilized corpus back into some semblance of an active state. Time to refuel. His convalescence had left him ravenous. Almost an hour had passed by the time he climbed out of M&R in search of whatever the galley might serve up. He was halfway across the hub before he noticed the light bleeding from the spoke. A snapshot of the past, a corpse laid out on the lawn. Brooks didn't know which element was the more incongruous. The lawn, he supposed. At least that was unexpected. Not so much a lawn as a patchy, threadbare rug of blue-green grass, rusty in the dim long wave vampires preferred, ripped from the walls of the hab and strewn haphazardly across the deck. Vampires had OCD, Brooks remembered vaguely. The mythical ones, at least, not the ancient flesh-and-blood predators that had inspired them. 17th-century folk legends had it that you could drive a vampire to distraction by the simple act of throwing salt in its path. Some supernatural brain circuit would compel it to drop everything and count the grains. Brooks thought he'd read that somewhere, probably not peer-reviewed. For all he knew, that ridiculous superstition might have at least a rootlet in neurological reality. It certainly wasn't any more absurd than the crucifix glitch. Maybe some pattern-matching hiccup in those omnisavant brains, some feedback loop gone over the top. Maybe Valerie had fallen victim to the same subroutine, seen all those thousands of epiphytic blades and torn them from their bulkhead beds with her bare fingernails, counting each leaf as it fluttered to the deck in a half-hearted chlorophyllous blizzard. Of course, the catch was that vampires didn't have to count. They would simply see the precise number of salt grains or grass leaves in an instant. Know that grand seven-digit total without ever going through the conscious process of adding it up. Any village peasant who sacrificed 2 seconds scattering salt in his path would buy himself a tenth of a second's grace, tops. Not a great rate of exchange. Maybe the zombie hadn't known that, though. Maybe the homunculus behind the eyes had rebooted just in time to see what was coming. Maybe it somehow wrested control back from all those shortcuts and back alleys and tried one last-ditch Hail Mary with nothing left to lose. Maybe Valerie had let it, watching, amused, maybe even played along, pretended to count each falling blade while her dinner turned the deck into a haphazard shag rug. Maybe the zombie hadn't even cared. Maybe it had just lain down on command and waited to be eaten. Maybe Valerie had just wanted a tablecloth. The zombie's throat had been slashed. It lay spread-eagled on its stomach, naked, face turned to the side. The right buttock had been carved away. The quads, one long strip of calf muscle. There was flesh above and flesh below. In between, A flensed femur connected the lower leg to the torso, socketed into the broad, scraped spatula of the pelvic girdle. There was very little blood. Everything had been cauterized.
"You never checked it out," Brooks said.
Sengupta zoomed the view. The gory table setting expanded across the window. Blades of grass grew to the size of bamboo shoots. Tooth marks resolved like jagged furrows on bared, bloody bone. Some kind of wire snaked through the grass, barely visible even at this magnification, and disappeared beneath the half-eaten corpse.
"Found 8 wires, don't know what for exactly, but that thing wasn't exactly Secret Santa, you know. Carnage said probably booby traps, and Carnage is probably right for once. She wanted us to see this."
"How do you know?"
"This is the only feed she didn't break." Sengupta waved the recording off the bulkhead.
"So you jettisoned the Habs?"
She nodded. "Too risky to go in, too risky to leave him there."
Another feed abutted the first, a view down the truncated spoke that had once led to Valerie's lair. It ended after only 20 meters now, in a pulsing orange disc flashing, "unpressurized," back up the tunnel at 2-second intervals. Just like the commons spoke opposite, cut loose in turn to keep the vectors balanced. He remembered downhill conversations, the sound of glasses clinking together.
"Shit," he said. "It's not like they're not all the same, you know. They all got the same plumbing and life support."
"I know.
And it's not like we're going to run out of food or air, what with everybody being dead and..."
"I fucking know," Brooks snapped, and was surprised when Sengupta fell immediately silent. He sighed. "It's just, the only half-decent moments I've had on this whole bloody trip were in commons, you know?" She didn't speak for a moment, and when she did, Brooks couldn't make out the words.
"What did you say?"
"You talked to him down there," she mumbled. "I know that, but it doesn't matter. Even if it was still here, he's not. He just sits up in the attic and runs those signals over and over like he never even left Icarus."
"He lost his son," Brooks said. "It changed him. Of course it changed him."
"Oh, yeah." She barely spoke above a whisper. Something in that voice made Brooks long for the trademark hyena laugh. "It changed him, all right."
No excuses left. Nothing else to do. He ascended into the hub, breached its sky into the guts beyond. Hissing bronchioles, cross-hatched vertebrae, straight-edged intestines. He moved like an old man. Free fall and residual paralysis and the spacesuit he'd scavenged from the cargo bay airlock all conspiring to take him to new depths of clumsiness. Up ahead, the paint around the docking hatch splashed the surrounding topography with the usual diffuse glow.
"This is where the shadows come," Brooks realized. "Every other corner of the crown is bright as a swimming pool now that the hold's off limits, now that Valerie's cave has been cut loose. Shadows don't have a chance back there. They've got nowhere else to go."
"Welcome back to the land of the living."
Jim Moore turned softly in the rafters, just past the airlock. The lines of his face, the edges of limbs, moved in and out of eclipse.
"This is living?" Brooks tried.
"This is the waiting list."
He thought he might have seen a smile. Brooks pushed himself across the attic and pulled a welding torch from the tool rack. Checked the charge, hefted the mass. Jim Moore watched from a distance, his face full of shadow.
Jim? About?
"Enemy territory,"
Moore said.
"Couldn't be helped."
"Yeah. A fifth of the world's energy supply, in the hands of an intelligent slime mold from outer space. Not a cost-benefit decision," Brooks envied. "The collateral, though..." Moore looked away.
"They'll make do."
Maybe he was right. Firefall had slowed Earth's headlong rush to off-world antimatter. A power cord stretched across 150 million kilometers was far too vulnerable for a universe in which godlike extraterrestrials appeared and vanished at will. There were backups in place, fusion and forced photosynthesis, geothermal spikes driven deep into the Earth's crust to tap the leftover heat of creation. Belts would be tightened, lives might be lost, but the world would make do. It always had.
the beggars and the choosers and the spoiled, insatiable generations with their toys and their power-hungry virtual worlds. They would not run out of air, at least. They would not freeze to death in the endless, arid wastes between the stars. For Moore so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. Twice.
Anyway, Moore added, we'll know soon enough.
Brooks chewed his lip. How long, exactly?
Could be home in a couple of weeks,
Moore said indifferently.
You'd have to ask Sengupta.
A couple? But the trip down took...
Using an ICAN, running on half a tank, and keeping our burns to an absolute minimum. We're on purebred, beamed core antimatter now. We could make it to Earth in a few days if we opened the throttle. We'd just be going too fast to stop when we got there. End up braking halfway to Centauri.
Or somewhere in between, Brooks thought. He looked across the compartment. Moore pinwheeled slowly through light and shadow and looked back. This time, the smile was as unmistakable as it was cryptic.
Don't worry about it,
he said. About?
We're not headed for the Oort. I'm not taking you away on some misguided, desperate search for my dead son.
Jim, I didn't.
There's no need. My son is alive.
Maybe 6 months ago. Maybe even now. I supposed it's possible. Not in 6 months, though. Not after the telematter stream winks out and leaves Theseus to freeze in the dark. Not after you cut him adrift. Jim.
My son is alive, Moore said again. And he's coming home.
Brooks didn't say anything for a while. Finally. How do you know?
I know.
Brooks pushed the torch with one hand into the other, felt the solid reality of mass and inertia without, the fragility of aching body parts within. Okay, I should take some samples.
Of course, Sengupta and her invading slime mold.
Doesn't cost anything to check it out.
Of course not.
Moore reached out a casual hand, anchored himself to an off-duty ladder.
I take it the suit's a condom.
No point in taking chances. Watching Moore in his yellow paper jumpsuit, the colonel's naked hand clenched on untested territory.
No helmet,
Moore observed. No point in going overboard, either. If Portia ran on ambient thermal, it wouldn't be getting enough joules from the bulkhead to sprout any pseudopods on short notice. Besides, Brooks felt stupid enough as it was. Under Moore's bemused gaze, he positioned himself to one side of the hatch and dialed the beam down to short focus. Smart paint sparked and blistered along the lip of the hatch. Nothing screamed or recoiled. No tentacles extruded from the metal in frantic acts of self-defense. Brooks scraped a sample from the scored periphery of the burn, another from the untouched surface a few centimeters further out. He moved systematically around the edge of the hatch, taking a sample every 40 centimeters or so.
Will you be using that on me?
Moore wondered behind him. I should. I don't think that's necessary just yet. Moore nodded, his face impassive.
Well, change your mind. You know where I am.
Brooks smiled. I wish I did, my friend. I really wish I did. But I don't have a fucking clue. Out of the attic, into the hub. Looks like the hub anyway. Could be a lining. Could be a skin. Through the equator, from frozen north to pirouetting south. Try not to touch the grate on your way through. Could be watching me right now. I could be swimming through an eyeball. Don't be an idiot, Brooks. Portia had years in Icarus. You were there for 3 weeks. Not nearly enough time to grow enough new skin to... Unless it didn't grow new lining. Unless it just redistributed the old. Unless it spent all those years building up extra post-biomass as an investment against future expansion. It couldn't just ooze through the front door and down the throat without anyone noticing. Coasting between an eyeball and an iris now, one open, one shut, both silver, both blind. No kinetic waste heat, No mass alarms. Unless it moved slowly enough to blend in with the noise. Unless it happens to know a little more about the laws of thermodynamics than we do. Down the spoke, putting on weight, staring hard at the gloved fingers clenched around their handhold. Alert for subtle mycelia threading between suit and stirrup. Eyes open for any bead of moisture there, some meniscus of surface tension that might belie a film in motion. You're being paranoid. You're being an idiot. This is just a precaution against a remote possibility. That's all this is. Don't go off the deep end. You're Dan Brooks. You're not Rakshi Sengupta. You only made her. He heard her moving in the basement as he fed samples into the holding tray. He tried to ignore her foot taps and mutterings as the scrapings cycled through quarantine, as he gave in to reawakened hunger and wolfed down whatever the lab hab's bare-bones galley disgorged, swallowing not quite fast enough to stay ahead of the spirulina aftertaste. Finally, though, he gave in, pushed from above by Moore's matter-of-fact dissonance, pulled from below by Sengupta's compulsive scuttling. He climbed down out of the lab, maneuvered around the giant seed pod obstruction of Sengupta's tent beside his own. The pilot was running consensus on the naked bulkhead between two impoverished bands of astroturf. The crown of thorns rotated there in animatic real time, two of her limbs amputated at the elbow. We keep going at this rate, and we're going to be three spacesuits and a tank of O2 by the time we get home, Brooks mused. A dot on the map, Moore J, floated safely distant in the attic. Other readouts formed a sparse mosaic across the bulkhead. Brooks couldn't understand them all, but he was pretty sure that one or two involved the blocking of intercom feeds. She turned as his feet hit the deck, stared expectantly at his lapel. Jim, he said.
Yeah.
You said he'd changed. Don't have to take my word for it, you saw it yourself. He's been changing ever since we left LEO. Brooks shook his head. He was only distracted before. Preoccupied. Never delusional. Sengupta ran her fingers down the wall. File listings flew by too fast for Brooks to make out. He was transmitting into the Oort, did you know that? Even before we left Earth, he broke the law. Hell, he helped make that law after Firefall. Nobody else could get away with it, but man, he's the great Jim Moore, and he was sending messages. What kind of messages?
To Theseus.
Well, of course. He was with Mission Control.
And it talked back.
Rakshi, so what?
It's talking to him now,
Sengupta said. What? Through all the interference?
We're out of the solar static already, most of it anyhow, but he's been collecting those signals for way longer. Some of the timestamps go back 7 years, and they change. All the early stuff, that's all just telemetry, you know? Lots of voice logs, too, but mainly just data. All the sensor records, contingency analyses, and about a million different scenarios that Vampire that Saristi was running when they were closing on target. It was dense. There was noise all over the signal, but the streams were redundant, so you can make it out if you run it through the right filters, right? And then Theseus goes dark, you don't hear anything for a while, and then there's this.
She fell silent. There's what, Rock? Brooks prompted gently. She took a breath.
There's this other signal, not tight beam, omnidirectional, washing over the whole inner sys.
He said Theseus went dark, Brooks remembered. They went in and lost contact, and that was all anybody knew.
Oh, he knew. It's really thin, and it's so degraded you can barely make it out even with every filter and noise correction algorithm in the arsenal. I don't think you'd even see it if you didn't already know it was there, but Colonel Carnage, man, he knew. He picked it out, and it's...
Her fingers danced and jittered in the air between them. The faintest breeze of static wafted through the hab, the moan of a distant ghost.
That it? Brooks asked. Almost, but then you add the last couple of Fourier's and...
And a voice. Thin, faint, sexless. There was no timbre to it, no cadence, no sense of any feeling behind the words. Any humanity it ever might have contained had been eroded away by dust and distance and the dull microwave rumble of a whole universe roaring in the background. There was nothing left but the words themselves, not reclaimed from static so much as built from the stuff, a whisper on the void.
Imagine you are Ciri Keaton. You wake in an agony of resurrection. Record-shattering bout of sleep apnea, spanning 140. Feel your blood, syrupy, forcing its way through arteries shriveled by months on standby. The body inflates in painful increments. Blood vessels dilate. Flesh peels apart from flesh, ribs crack. Sudden, unaccustomed flexion. Your joints have seized up through disuse. You're a stick man, frozen, rigor vitae. You'd scream if you had the breath.
The hab fell silent.
What the fuck was that?
Brooks whispered after a very long time.
I don't know.
Sengupta drummed her fingers on her thigh. The start of a story. It's been coming through in bits and pieces every few years according to the timestamps. I don't think it's finished either. I think it's still in progress.
But what is... I don't know, okay? It says it's Ciri Keaton. And there's something underneath it, too. Not words exactly. I don't know.
Can't be.
Doesn't matter what you or I think, he thinks it's Ciri Keaton, and you know what? He's talking back to it. I think he's talking back.
My son is alive.
He's got a while to wait. If that's really coming from the Oort, it'll be a solid year before he can even think about getting an answer.
Sengupta shrugged and looked at the wall.
He's coming home.
Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from nature. Stella Rossiter. Negative. 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 Torn lattices and broken nanowires and mangled microdiodes. Eviscerated smart paint. Nothing else. For hours now, he'd let worst-case scenarios play out in his imagination. Portia had expanded into the crown. Portia had spread past the attic. Portia had oozed invisibly across every bulkhead and every surface, coated the skins of tents and of crew members, wrapped itself around every particle of food each of them had taken into their mouths from the moment they'd docked. Portia enveloped him like a second skin. Portia was inside him, measuring and analyzing and corroding him from the outside in and the inside out. Portia was everywhere. Portia was everything.
Bullshit.
His neocortex knew as much, even as his brainstem stole its insights and twisted them to its most paranoid ends. Whatever Portia's ultimate origin, it was the telematter system that had built it. Lasers etching blank condensates into thinking microfilms that planned and plotted and spread across each new frontier like a plague of cognition. However far it had spread, however much or little had infiltrated the crown, it couldn't keep growing once severed from the engine of its creation. They hadn't been docked that long. Surely the enemy couldn't have achieved anything but the most superficial penetration of the front line. The samples were clean. Which proved, of course, absolutely nothing. Aboard Icarus, it had sprung shut like a leg-hold trap. But it had had unlimited power to play with, and 8 years to learn how to use it. One passive filter on the solar panels, damped by 0.001%. One short-circuited electrical line, sparking and heating the surrounding metal. That's all it would have taken. Just time. And a little Brownian energy to keep it fed. What had Sengupta said so offhandedly, just before Portia had attacked? Little warm in there. It can't sprint without stockpiling energy, he mused. Maybe it builds up a detectable heat print before it pounces. Sengupta poked her head up through the floor.
Find anything?
Brooks shook his head as she climbed onto the deck.
Yeah, well, I did. I found how that fucking vampire turned you to stone, and better you than me, sorry, but it could have been me or Carnage either, for all I know. I think she did it to all of us.
Did what, exactly?
You ever been scared, Roach?
All the time.
Rakshi, we almost died. Before that... Sengupta's head jerked back, Fourth, scared for no reason, scared just going to the bathroom.
Something jumped in his stomach.
What did you find?
She threw a camera feed onto the wall, an eye in the attic, looking down along the empty compartment to the hub hatch. Sengupta zoomed obliquely on a patch of bulkhead beside the secondary airlock. Someone had scrawled some kind of glyph across that surface, a tangle of multicolored curves and corners that might have passed for some cubist's rendition of a very simple neural circuit.
I don't remember seeing that before, Brooks murmured. Yeah, you do, you just don't remember it. Only lasts 200 milliseconds, pure luck this showed up on a screen grab. You see it, but you don't remember it, and it scares the shit out of you.
Not scaring me now.
This is just one frame, Roach. It's part of an animation, but the cameras don't scan fast enough, and they're all gone now. I had to sieve like a bugger to even get this much.
He stared at the image, a jagged little tangle of lines and arabesques, a piece of abstract graffiti, maybe a hand's width across. It almost looked meaningful when spied from the corner of the eye, like a collection of letters on the verge of forming a word. It dissolved into gibberish when you looked at it. Even cut out of sequence, even spied from this oblique angle, it made his brain itch. It's like she painted gang signs, he said softly, all over the ship.
That's not all she did, the way she moved, remember? I said I didn't like the way she moved, all those little clicks and ticks. Shit, even that time she attacked me and then you, I saw her whisper things in your ear. What did she say to you, huh?
I don't know. Brooks realized. I don't remember.
Yeah, you do. Just like that time in Budapest. Changed your wiring with vibrations, like lining up a bunch of beer glasses. Pretty wild, right?
Sengupta tapped her temple three times in rapid succession. Hard.
Not even radical. I mean, you can't hear a word or smell a fart without your brain rewiring at least a bit. That's how brains are. Everything reprograms you. She just figured out where to stamp on the floor to make you freeze up on command. Could have happened to me just as easy.
It did happen to you, Brooks said.
Why did you attack her, Rock? I saw you in the hub. You went at her like a rabid dog. What got into you?
I don't know. It was like she was making these noises. They just really pissed me off. I don't know. Couldn't help myself.
Misophonia. Brooks barked a soft, bitter laugh. She gave you misophonia.
Images from Simon Fraser. Valerie, strapped to a chair. Tapping on the armrest. Even back then she was doing it. Even when they were torturing her, she was reprogramming them. He couldn't help laughing.
What? Sengupta said. What?
You know the secret of a good memory? He bit back on another laugh.
You know what really kicks the hippocampus into overdrive? Burns tracks into your brain faster and deeper than anything this side of direct neuroinduction? Roach, you gotta fear.
Brooks shook his head.
All that time, playing the monster. I thought she was just into sadistic games, you know? I thought she just got off on scaring us. But she was never that gratuitous. She was only cranking up the baud rate.
Sengupta smacked her lips and looked out the window. He snorted softly.
Even that time in the attic, Lee and I... We couldn't even look. We just knew she was up there. But we were facing each other, Rock. We were each terrified by something to our left, but we were facing each other.
Of course we were. It's obvious. Why didn't I see it before?
I bet she wasn't there at all. It was just temporoparietal hallucinations. Night hags. Sensed presence bullshit.
Roach remembers. Sengupta was almost whispering. Roach is starting to wake up.
She was moving us around like checkers. Brooks didn't know whether to be awed or terrified. The whole time. And what else did she program into us, huh? We gonna start seeing things that aren't there or go walking naked on the hull?
Brooks thought about it.
I don't think so. Not if she hacked us all the same way, anyway. Basic things, sure. Fear, lust. Stuff that's universal.
He smiled, a bit grimly, at the thought of the Crown's surviving denizens sprouting pre-programmed hard-ons and spiked nibbles.
And that is really not a picture I need in my head right now. You want to hack higher-level behavior? You're getting into formative childhood experiences, specific memory pathways. Too many individual differences for one size fits all. Sengupta clicked her teeth. That's old Roach talking. New Roach should know better. Who knows what that... She couldn't hack the bicamerals, he said slowly. What? These tricks. They exploit classic pathways. They'd never work on someone who'd remixed their brain circuitry. She had to get them out of the way. 1,000 pieces fell suddenly, blindingly into place. That's why she attacked the monastery. That's why she didn't just knock on the front door with an offer. She wanted to goad them into getting noticed. She knew how the roaches would respond, right down to a weaponized biological, just lethal enough to keep the hive out of the way for the trip, but not lethal enough to derail the mission completely. Fuck! He sucked in his breath at the thought. You see the problem, Sengupta said. I don't see anything but problems. Which one in particular? She's a vampire. She's pre-post-human all wrapped up into one. These fuckers solve NP-complete problems in their heads, and they drop us like ghost stones, and she's stupid enough to just accidentally get locked outside when we leave. Brooks shook his head. She burned. I saw her. Ask Jim. You ask him. She turned, her eyes lifting from the deck the moment his face fell from view. Go on, he's right up there. No hurry, Brooks said after a moment. I'll see him when he comes down. To Stern, the transplanted parasol held back the sun, a great black shield, coruscations of flame still flickering intermittently past its edges. Ahead, the stars. One at least crawled with life and chaos, too distant yet to draw the eye. More hypothesis than hope, but closing, closing. That was something. In between, a metal spine webbed in scaffolding, lumpy with metal tumors, spokes and halves and cauterized stumps sweeping one way across the sky, a weighted baton sweeping the other to balance the vectors. The hub. The hold. A cylindrical cavern abutting the shield to Stern, its back end ragged and gaping into space. Once it had been full of cargo and components and thinking cancers. Now, it was packed with tons of uranium and precious micrograms of antihydrogen and great toroidal superconductors big as houses. And shadows everywhere, webs and jigsaws cast by 100 dim lanterns decorating the tops of antennae, or the latches of access panels, or mounted as porch lights around the edges of half-forgotten emergency airlocks. Sengupta had turned them all on and maxed them all out, but they were waypoints, not searchlights. They didn't so much illuminate the darkness as throw it into contrast. No matter. Her drone didn't need light to see. She'd eschewed the usual maintenance bots that crawled spider-like along the hull, patching and probing and healing the scars left by micrometeorites. Too obvious, she'd said. Too easy to hack. Instead, she'd built one from scratch. Remote printed it on the fabricator still humming away in the refitted hold. Decompiled one of the standard bots for essential bits of lanthanum and thulium, and built the rest from the crown's matter stockpile, like Yahweh breathing life into clay. Now it made its painstaking way over a landscape of struts and conduits, shadows and darkness overlaid with false color maps on a dozen wavelengths. There! Sengupta cried for the fourth time in as many hours. And then, fuck! Just another pocket of outgassing. By now, Brooks had learned not to worry about the myriad leaks in the hull. The Crown of Thorns was a sieve. Most ships were. Fortunately, the holes in that mesh were pretty small. It would take years for the internal air pressure to decline significantly, barring a direct hit from anything larger than a lentil. They'd die of starvation or radiation sickness long before they had to worry about asphyxiation. Belching hell, another leak, I swear! Sengupta's voice trailed off, rebooted. Wait a second. The telltales looked the same to Brooks, the faintest wisp of yellow on infrared. The kind of heat a few million molecules might retain for a moment or two after bleeding out from some warmer core. Looks like more microgassing to me. Smaller than the last one, even.
Yeah, but look where it is.
Along one of the batwing struts where the droplet radiator sprouted from the spine. So? No atmo there, no tanks or lines either.
One long arm swept through the near distance, like the candle-lit vane of a skeletal windmill. Another. Sengupta played with herself. Her marionette picked a careful route through dark, jumbled topography. Something hunkered on the hull ahead, its visible outlines buried in shadow. Infrared showed nothing but that diaphanous micronebula dissipating across the hull.
Can't cloak thermal emissions, Brooks remembered. Not if you're an endotherm.
That's not enough of a heat trace. Not if you're a cockroach, plenty big enough if you can shut yourself off for a few decades.
Just LIDAR it.
Sengupta jerked her head back and forth.
No chance, nothing active, there could be tripwires.
It can't be her, Brooks told himself. I saw her burn.
What about Starlamp, he wondered. I'm using Starlamp, we just gotta get closer.
But if she's tripwired against active sensors...
Proximity alert, I know.
Sengupta nodded and tapped and kept her eyes on the prize.
But that would be active too, and I could pick it up, plus I'm hiding a lot.
She was. The bot's eye saw struts and plating more often than shadows within shadows. Sengupta was keeping her head down on approach. At the moment, they could see nothing but the looming face of some small, grated butte dead ahead.
Right around the corner now, this should do it.
The drone farted hydrogen and drifted gently out of eclipse. Still nothing but faint, amorphous yellow on infrared. On Starlamp, though, a silver body, legs straight, arms spread, wired against the side of the ship. Boosted photons rendered the body in fragments, ridges of mirrored fabric glinting in thousand-year-old starlight, creases that swallowed any hint of mass or structure. The spacesuit was a patchwork of bright strips and dark absences, the shell of some tattered mummy with half its bandages ripped away and nothing at all underneath. But the right shoulder shone pale and clear, the double E crest boasting the unsurpassed quality of Extreme Environments Incorporated. Protective gear, a name tag, programmable for the easy identification of multiple users. Luterote.
It can't be, Brooks thought. I saw her. She was dead. Her faceplate was in pieces. She was not unconscious. She was not stunned. That was not her I saw pounding on the hatch. Awake again? Running for her life? Too frantic to notice that she'd awakened in someone else's suit? It was not Liana we left to burn. It was Valerie. It was Valerie. We abandoned no others who were not already dead. We did not do this.
Sengupta was making noises somewhere between laughter and hysteria.
I told you, I told you, I told you!
Not stupid at all. She knows what she's doing.
Out there all this time, Brooks thought, hiding. I would never have found her. I would never have even looked. Maybe Portia's hiding too. Maybe I just haven't looked hard enough.
We have to tell Jim, he said.
Will you look at that?
Moore remarked. Liana's space suit flickered on the dome, a snapshot taken before Sengupta had pulled the drone back for fear of setting off alarms. Not that a live feed would have been any more dynamic.
It's Valerie! It's fucking Valerie!
Apparently.
It can't be,
Brooks thought for the thousandth time, the voice in his head weaker with each iteration. By now, it was barely whispering.
I told you we can't trust.
She seems harmless enough for now,
the colonel remarked.
Harmless? Are you felching crazy? Don't you remember what she...
Moore cut her off.
There's no way that suit could support an active metabolism all the way back to Earth, and there's no sign of any kind of octopus rig. She's gone undead for the trip home. Probably expects to revive and jump ship when we dock in LEO. Waking up earlier wouldn't accomplish anything except using up her O2.
Good, then I say we give the bot some teeth and go scrape her off the hull like a goddamn barnacle while we got the chance.
By all means, if you think she hasn't set up any defenses against just that scenario.
If you're certain the hull isn't booby-trapped with a nanogram of antimatter set to blow a hole in the ship if anything disturbs her. I assume you realized that she's smart. You certainly pulled your drone back fast enough.
That gave her pause. What do we do then?
She's waiting for us to dock. So we don't dock.
Moore shrugged.
We jump ship and let the crown burn up on re-entry.
And then what, surf back through the atmosphere on top of a passing commsat? If I was supposed to pack a shuttle, nobody told me.
One thing at a time. For now, just continue your hull crawl, in case she's left anything else out there for us to find. If you'll excuse me.
He drifted around his own axis and pushed himself off the deck.
I have my own work to do.
He disappeared into the attic. Brooks and Sengupta stayed at the mirror ball. Buried in the shadows of some obscure province on the hull, Valerie lay still as death in her stolen skin. What does she want? Brooks wondered. What all of them want, I guess, to touch the face of God. The common enemy, he remembered. That whole enemy of my enemy thing went down the toilet the moment she slaughtered the bicams. Whatever it was, she wanted sole access. She's got plans for God, oh yeah, they all did. Too bad God had plans for them, too. Maybe she wasn't happy just touching the face of God, he mused. Maybe she wants to bring God home as a pet. Maybe, while we've been going crazy looking for Portia in here, it's been out there all along, sealed up in a Ziploc bag. Another good reason to burn this fucking ship, as if we needed one. Whatever those plans were, he said, they're all dead in the water now. Oh, you think so, huh? Jim's, oh, Jim, that's a good one, because vampires are no match for roach plans, are they? So how did she get out then in the first place, huh? How come she isn't still strapped to a chair solving puzzles at SFU? Every vampire ever brought back from the junkyard, scrupulously isolated from their own kind. Every aspect of their environment regulated and monitored. Hemmed in by crosses and right angles, mortally dependent on precisely rationed drugs to keep them from seizing at the sight of a window pane. Creatures that, for all their terrifying strength and intelligence, couldn't even open their eyes on a city street without keeling over. Valerie, walking blithely out of her cage one night, and scaring the piss out of prey in a local bar, for Christ's sakes, and then walking back in again, just to show that she could. I don't know, Brooks admitted. I do, a single jerky nod. It wasn't just her, there were others, there were three other vampires in that lab, and they worked together. He shook his head. They'd never have met. Vampires are hardly ever allowed in the same wing of a building at the same time, let alone the same room. And if they did meet, they'd be more likely to tear out each other's throats than draw up escape plans. Oh, they drew up their plans all right. They all just did it alone. Brooks felt a contradiction rising on his tongue. Then it sunk in. Shit, he said. Yeah. You're saying they just knew what the others were going to do? They just... Elevated respiration from the short redhead prey consistent with conspecific encounter within the past 200 breaths, Sengupta chanted. East-south corridor is public, so exclude them. Conspecific must have been moved 20 meters along the north tunnel no more than 125 breaths ago. Like that. Each observing the most insignificant behavioral cues, the subtlest architectural details as their masters herded them from lab to cell to conference room. Each able to infer the presence and location of the others, to independently derive the optimal specs for a rebellion launched by X individuals in Y different locations at Z time. And then they'd acted in perfect sync, knowing that others they'd never met would have worked out the same scenario. How do you know? He whispered. It's the only way. I tried to make it work from every other angle, but it's the only model that fits. You roaches never stood a chance. Jesus, Brooks thought. Pretty good hack, right? Admiration mingled with the fear in Sengupta's voice. Can you imagine what those fuckers could do if they actually could stand to be in the same room together? He shook his head, amazed, trying to take it in. That's why we made sure they couldn't. Made? I thought they were just, you know, really territorial. Nobody's that territorial. Someone must have amped their responses to keep them from ganging up on us. Brooks shrugged. Like the crucifix glitch, only deliberate.
How do you know that I haven't seen that anywhere?
Like you said, Rock, it's the only model that fits. How do you think the line could even breed if their default response was to eviscerate each other on sight? Call it the divide and conquer glitch, he smiled bitterly. Oh, we were good.
They're better, Sengupta said.
Look, I don't care how helpless Carnage thinks that thing is, I'm not taking my fucking eyes off it, and I'm firewalling every onboard app and every subroutine I can find until I check every last one for logic bombs.
Now there's a quick weekend project. Aloud. Anything else?
I don't know, I'm working on it, but how do I know she hasn't already figured everything I could think of? No matter what I do, I could be playing right into her hands.
Well, for starters, Brooks suggested, what about welding the airlocks shut? You can't hack sheet metal.
Sengupta took her eyes off the horizon, turned her head. For a moment, Brooks even thought she might look at him.
When it's time to leave, we cut a hole, he continued. Or blow one. I assume this isn't a rental. If it is, I'm pretty sure the damage deposit's already a write-off.
He waited for the inevitable put-down.
That's a great idea, Sengupta said at last. Brute force baseline thinking. Should have thought of it myself. Fuck safety protocols. I'll do the hold and the spokes. You do the attic.
The docking hatch wouldn't take a weld. It was too reactive. Its reflexes, almost the stuff of living systems. Clenched tight, it could withstand the point-blank heat of lasers and still dilate on command like a dark-adjusting eye. Brooks had to make do with bulkhead panels from the attic, strip them from their frames, and weld them into place across the airlock's inner wall. Jim Moore appeared at his side, wordlessly helped him maneuver the panels into place.
Thanks, Brooks grunted.
Moore nodded.
Good idea, although you could probably fab a better.
We're keeping it low-tech, in case Valerie hacked the fabbers.
Ah,
the colonel nodded.
Rachi's idea, I'm guessing.
Uh-huh.
Moore held the panel steady at one end, while Brooks set the focus.
Serious trust issues, that one. Doesn't like me at all.
You can't really blame her, given the way you folks manipulated her.
Brooks lined up the keyhole, fired. Down at the tip of the welder, metal flared bright as a sun with an electrical snap, but the lensing field damped that searing light down to a candle flame. The tang of metal vapor stung Brooks's sinuses.
I don't think she knows about that,
Moore said mildly.
And that wasn't me, in any case.
Someone like you, anyway. Aim. Fire. Snap.
Not necessarily.
Brooks looked up from the weld. Jim Moore stared back, impassively.
Jim, you told me how it works. Herded into the service of agendas they'd never support in 1,000 years, remember? Somebody thought that up.
Maybe. Maybe not.
Moore's eyes focused on some spot just past Brooks's left shoulder.
You're barely even here, Brooks thought. Even now, half of you is caught up in some kind of seance.
There's a whole other network out there,
Moore was saying.
Orthogonal to all the clouds. Interacting with them like, I don't know, the way dark matter interacts with baryonic matter, maybe. Weak effects, and subtle. Very tough to trace, but omnipresent. Ideally suited for the kind of tweaks we use to marshal our forces, as we like to say. And do you know what's really remarkable about it, Daniel?
Tell me.
As far as we know, nobody built the damn thing. We just discovered it, turned it to our own ends. The theorists say it could just be an emergent property of networked social systems, like your wife's supraconscious networks.
Uh-huh, Brooks said after a moment.
You don't buy it.
He shook his head. A stealth supernet, fine-tuned for the manipulation of pawns with a specific skill set suited to military applications, and it just emerged?
Moore smiled faintly.
Of course. No complex, finely tuned system could ever just evolve. Something must have created it.
Ouch, Brooks thought.
I'll admit, I've heard that argument before, Moore said. I just never thought I'd hear it from a biologist.
Evidently, half of him was enough. An instrument has been developed in advance of the needs of its possessor. Alfred Russel Wallace. He awoke to the sound of jagged breathing. Shadows moved across the skin of his tent. Rock? The flap split down the middle. She crawled inside like some heartbroken infant returning to the womb. Even in here, cheek to jowl, she would not look at his face. She squirmed around and lay down with her back to him, curled up, fists clenched. Brooks began.
I told you I didn't like him. I never did, and now look, Sengupta said softly. We can't trust him, Roach. I never really liked him, but you could count on him. At least you know where he stood. Now he's just gone all the time. Don't know what he is anymore.
He lost his son. He blames himself. People deal with it in different ways.
It's more than that. He lost his kid years ago.
But then he got him back, in a small way, for a little while. Can you imagine what that must be like? To deal with the loss of someone you loved, only to find out that they're still out there somewhere, and they're talking, and it doesn't matter if they're talking to you or not, it's still them. It's new. You're not just playing a sim or wallowing in the same old video. She's actually out there, and... He caught himself and wondered if she'd noticed. I could have her back, he told himself. Not in the flesh, maybe. Not here in the real world, but real time, at least. Better than this thin graveside monologue Jim clings to. All I have to do is knock on heaven's door. Which was, of course, the one thing he'd sworn to never do.
He says Ciri's alive, Sengupta whispered. Says he's coming home.
Maybe he is. That clip from the transmission, right near the beginning, you know? The coffin. She ran her finger across the inside of the tent. Words wrote themselves in her wake.
Point of view matters. I see that now. Blind, talking to myself. Trapped in a coffin falling past the edge of the solar system.
Brooks nodded. That's the one. If you take that at face value, he's not on board Theseus anymore.
Lifeboat, Sengupta said. Shuttle.
Sounds like he's coasting in. It'll take him forever, but there'll be a hibernaculum on board. He rested a hand on her shoulder. Maybe Jim's not wrong. Maybe his son's coming home. He lay there, breathing in the scent of oil and mold and plastic and sweat, watching his breath ruffle her hair.
Something's coming, she said at last. Maybe not Ciri.
Why do you say that?
It just sounds wrong the way it talks. There are these ticks in the speech pattern. It keeps saying, imagine you're this and imagine you're that, and it sounds so recursive sometimes. It sounds like it's trying to run some kind of model.
Imagine you're Ciri Keaton, he remembered, and gleaned from a later excerpt of the same signal. Imagine you're a machine.
It's a literary affectation. He's trying to be poetic, putting yourself in the character's head, that kind of thing. Why do you have to put yourself in your own head, though, eh? Why do you have to imagine what it's like to be you?
She shook her head, a sharp little jerk of denial.
All those splines and filters and NCAs, they take out so much, you know. You can't hear the words without them, but you can't hear the voice unless you strip them away. So I went back through all the steps, I looked for some sweet spot where you might be able to hear, and I don't know if I did, the signal's so weak and there's so much fucking noise, but there's this one little spot 47 minutes in where you can't make out the words, but you can sort of make out the voice. I can't be sure, you can never be sure, but I think the harmonics are off.
Off how?
Ciri Keaton's male, I don't think this is male.
A woman's voice?
Maybe a woman, if we're lucky.
What are you saying, Rakshi? You're saying it might not be human?
I don't know, but it just feels wrong. And what if it's not a literary affectation? What if it's some kind of simulation? What if something out there is literally trying to imagine what it's like to be Ciri Keaton?
The voice of God, Brooks murmured.
I don't know, I really don't, but whatever it is, it's got its hooks into a professional killer with a zombie switch in his brain, and I don't know why, but I know a hack when I see one.
How could it know enough to hack him? How would it even know he exists?
It must have known Siri, and Siri knew him. Maybe that's enough.
I don't know, he admitted after a bit. Hacking a human mind over a 6-month time lag? It seems...
That's enough touching, she said.
What?
She shrugged his hand off her shoulder.
I know you Jerrys like to touch and have meat sex and everything, but the rest of us don't need people to get us off, if you don't mind. I'll stay here, but it doesn't mean anything, okay?
This is my...
What?
She said, facing away.
Nothing.
He settled back down, maneuvered his back against the wall of the tent. It left maybe 30 centimeters between them. He might even be able to sleep if neither of them rolled over. If he felt the least bit tired.
Rakshi wasn't sleeping either, though. She was scratching at her own commandeered side of the tent, bringing up tiny light shows on the wall, a little animatic of the crown, centered on the rafters where Moore, Jay, clung to a ghost, or danced on the strings of some unknowable alien agenda, or both. The metal landscape the drone traversed in search of countermeasures, the merest smudge of infrared where a sleeping monster hid in the shadows. There really weren't any safe places, Brooks reflected. Might as well feign what safety you could in numbers. The company of a friend, the warmth of a pet. It was all the same. All that mattered was the simple brainstem comfort of a body next to yours, huddled against the night. Sengupta turned her face a little, a cheekbone, the tip of a nose in partial eclipse.
Roach?
I really wish you'd stop calling me that.
What you said before, about losing people, different people deal in different ways, that's what you said, right?
That's what I said.
How do you deal?
I...
He didn't quite know how to answer.
Maybe the person you lose comes back someday. Maybe somebody else fits into the same space.
Sengupta snorted softly, and there was an echo of the old derision there.
You just sit around and wait?
No, I... get on with my life. Do other things.
Brooks shook his head, vaguely irritated.
I suppose you'd just whip up some customized consensus playmate.
Don't you fucking tell me what I'd do!
Brooks bit his lip.
Sorry.
Stupid old man. You know where the hot buttons are, and still you can't help pushing the damn things.
There was a bright side, though, to Colonel Carnage's deepening insanity, to Valerie's lethal waiting games, to ghosts haunting the ether, and uncertain fates waiting to pounce. At least Rakshi wasn't hunting him anymore. He wondered at that thought, a little surprised at Sengupta's place atop his own personal hierarchy of fear. She was just a human being, after all, unarmed flesh and blood. She wasn't some prehistoric nightmare or alien shapeshifter, no god or devil. She was just a kid, a friend even, insofar as she could even think in those terms. An innocent, who didn't even know his secret. Who was Rakshi Sengupta, next to monsters and cancers and a whole world on the brink? What was her grudge? Next to all those other terrors, closing in on all sides. It was a rhetorical question, of course. Sure, the universe was full of terrors. She was the only one he'd brought upon himself. His own hunt wasn't going so well. Of course, Portia wasn't quite so visible a target as Daniel Brooks. Brooks couldn't subsist on the ambient thermal energy of bulkhead atoms vibrating at room temperature. Couldn't flatten himself down to paper and wrap himself around a water pipe to mask even that meager heat print. He'd wondered about albedo or spectro, wondered if a probe built of very short wavelengths might be able to pick up the diffraction gratings that Portia used to talk. Perhaps it used them as camouflage as well, but the improvised detectors he fabbed turned up nothing, which didn't mean they didn't work, necessarily. Maybe it only meant that Portia kept to the crown's infinite fractal landscape of holes and crannies too small for bots and men. He was almost certain it couldn't launch an open attack without letting some tell slip beforehand. The heat signature of muscle analogs building a charge, the reallocation of mass sufficient to construct an appendage at some given set of coordinates. It could run, though, in some sort of post-biological baseline state,
powered by the subtle energy resonating from the crude mass of the real substrate into the superconducting intelligence of the false one. It could think and plan forever in that mode if bicameral calculations had been right. It could hide. The less he found, the more he feared. Something nearby was watching him. He felt it in his gut. "Ship's too damn noisy," he confided to Sengupta. "Thermally? Allometrically? Portia could be anywhere, everywhere. How would we know?" "It's not," she told him. "Why so sure? You were the one who warned me, back when..." "I thought it might have got in, yeah. Maybe it did, but not enough to get everywhere. It didn't coat everything. It didn't swallow us." "How do you know?" "It wanted to keep us in Icarus. It wouldn't have tried to stop us from leaving if we were still inside it. It's not everywhere," he thought. "It could still be anywhere." "Yeah, but not enough to take over. Just a little bit, lost and alone." There was something in her voice, almost like sympathy. "Yeah, well, why not?" she asked, although he had said nothing. "We know how that feels." Sailing up the center of the spine, navigating through the grand rotating bowl of the southern hemisphere, up through the starboard rabbit hole with the mirror ball gleaming to his left, Daniel Brooks, consummate parasite, finally at home in the weightless intestines of the Crown of Thorns. "I checked the numbers 3 times. I don't think Portia..." He stopped. His own face looked down at him across half the sky. "Oh, fuck." Rakshi Sengupta was a presence near the edge of vision, a vague blur of motion and color, more felt than seen. He had only to turn his head, and she would come into focus. "She knows, she knows, she knows." "I found the fucker," she said, and there was blood and triumph and terrible promise in her voice. He could not bring himself to face her. He could only stare at that incriminating portrait in front of him, at his personal and professional lives scrolling across the heavens big as the zodiac. Transcripts, publications, home addresses. Rona, ascendant. His goddamn swimming certificate from the 3rd grade. "This is him. This is the asshole who killed my... who killed 7,482 people. Daniel Brooks." She was no longer talking like Rakshi Sengupta, he realized, at some horrible remove. She was talking like someone else entirely. "I said I would find him, and I found him, and here he is." She's talking like Shiva the fucking destroyer. He floated there, dead to rights, waiting for some killing blow. "And now that I know who he is," Shiva continued, "I am going to survive that thing on the hull, and I am going to survive that thing in Colonel Carnage's head, and I am going to make it back to Earth, and I will hunt this fucker down and make him wish he had never been born." "Wait, what?" He forced back his own paralysis. He turned his head. His pilot, his confidant, his sworn nemesis came into focus. Her face, raised to the heavens, crawled with luminous reflections of his own damnation. She spared him a sidelong glance. Her lips were parted in a smile that would have done Valerie proud. "Want to come along for the ride?" "She's toying with me? This is some kind of twisted..." "Rakshi," he coughed, cleared a throat gone drier than Prineville. Tried again. "I don't know..." She raised one preemptive hand. "I know, I know. Priorities. Counting chickens. We have other things to do. But I've had friends wiped by the stormtroopers for hacking some senator's diary. And then this asshole racks up a 4-digit death toll and those same stormtroopers protect him. You know what I mean? So yeah, there are vampires and alien slime molds and a whole damn planet coming apart at the seams, but I can't do anything about that." Her gaze on the ground, she pointed to the sky. "This I can do something about." "You don't know who I am. I'm right here in front of you, and you've dredged up my whole sorry life, and you're not putting it together. How can you not be putting it together? Bring back a little balance into the social equation." Maybe it's the eye contact thing. He suppressed a hysterical little giggle. Maybe she just never looked at me in meat space.
There's no fucking justice anywhere unless you make your own.
Wow, Brooks thought, distantly amazed. Jim and his orthogonal networks, they really got your number. Why don't you have mine?